Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Paul Rudnick is not a poetry fan, but he loved David Rakoff's posthumous novel in verse. He'll be here to tell us about his review of Love, Dishonor, Marry, Die, Cherish, Perish.
And the poetry becomes part of the sort of gleeful whimsy and even the profundity of the book.
Not all literature out of Latin America is magical realism. Juan Gabriel Vasquez will join us to talk about his novel, The Sound of Things Falling, which is featured on this week's cover.
Magical realism is a sort of great new way to look at the world that García Márquez practically invented in the 60s, but it has nothing to do with my world.
Julie Bosman will join us with Notes from the Field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Paul Rudnick joins us to talk about his review of the late David Rakoff's posthumous book, Love, Dishonor, Marry, Die, Cherish, Perish. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for coming in. So you loved this book.
Oh, I did. I just thought it was extraordinary. And I'm just a longtime David Rakoff fan. In fact, I saw David on stage before I ever read him. This was years ago. And he was he's a wonderful actor. He was appearing in a play by David and Amy Sedaris, who listed themselves in the playbill as the Talent Family.
Now, everyone's going to be upset that they didn't get to see this.
Exactly. It was called One Woman's Shoe. And the premise of the play was that welfare recipients, to earn their checks, should be forced to do performance art. And Amy had done something off of the way she liked to distort her face using scotch tape. She was playing one of the welfare recipients, and David was playing a very elegant and very beleaguered social worker. And he was just great.
When was this?
Must have been easily 20 years ago. But I was so impressed with him. And then I started to read him and hear him on NPR. And I just thought he was astonishing. He was also one of those people, both on the page and in person, who you just felt such immediate warmth and something that drew people to him. You know,
yes.
You understood his fandom and you understood why people felt they knew him when all they'd done was read him.
But he'd also be quite caustic and biting in his wit.
Well, one of my favorite things he said was he had spent many years toiling in publishing before he became a published writer, and he really did not like the atmosphere. And there was one author who he had to deal with who was notoriously difficult, and this wasn't just from David. She was a nightmare.
Are you going to name names here?
Well, she has passed on, but no, because the circumstances of her death, and first she just lost consciousness, but was following a bout of cosmetic surgery.
You can go Google now.
Exactly. Not the way, really, where you want to go. But David immediately emailed a friend and asked, do you think that her being in a coma will affect the quality of her writing? Which was pretty accurate. So yes, David had a real edge to him.
And speaking of his performance, you cite in your review this great video that is now, you can see on YouTube, this performance he did for This American Life. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It is so heartbreaking and entertaining at the same time, which is, you know, the contradiction of David Rakoff, that it was, I think, 3 months before he died.
Yes.
And he walks out on stage and he's got his left hand is tucked into the pocket of his pants. And he explains that he's had surgery, his fourth in as many years, for cancer. And he initially had Hodgkin's disease, I think, at his 20s. So he was no stranger to his very serious illness. But he talks about how he has lost all feeling in his arm and can't move it or feel it. He talks about, I think he went to dinner with friends where people talked about what in your life still needed improving. And David talked about how, no, he used to believe that, his great work was just around the corner and that if he had just applied himself, that glory would be his. And he says, but that was all in the past and that's something he gave up, much like dancing. And he talks briefly about how he had danced a lot as a child. He said it was like a straight boy's obsession with baseball. And then he pauses and says, only better.
Right.
And then he talks about how he took dance at college and in New York, but it became another quote, an exercise in humiliation. So he's not going to dance. Then he steps away from the lectern, and we hear strains of Irving Berlin's just heartrending ballad, What'll I Do? And David dances. And it's very precise, and you just fall to pieces. And it's in no way sentimental. He's not milking the moment. It's just very matter of fact. And I've watched it again and again. And I, in the review, I say, you know, when it comes to life and death and dancing, that's how it's done. And I think a lot of people feel that about David and about all his books, and certainly about his latest, that it's a very specific magic to him.
Now, despite all of this, you were kind of primed to dislike this book, right? Because how do you feel about poetry?
Oh, to loathe it. Because as I say in the review, I am a very crass and ignorant person and a deeply committed poetry phobe. I think of poetry as a complete hoax. I rank it with opera and ballet in that regard.
People lie when they say they like it.
Completely. They're just too embarrassed. They're ashamed that anyone should think that they're the outcast of high culture. But I am unashamed. And this book is written entirely in rhyming couplets, so it should be my basic nightmare. And I adored it. It is so funny, and it is so sort of enchanting. And the poetry becomes part of the sort of gleeful whimsy and even the profundity of the book, that it just draws you in, and it doesn't take itself overly seriously. And I found that it was reminiscent of the most accessible and entertaining poets like Dorothy Parker or Ogden Nash, and also the sort of greater emotional depth of someone like Frank O'Hara. And I know that David was a big Frank O'Hara fan. So it has practically redeemed poetry for me, but I didn't need to be redeemed in terms of David Rakoff. I'd read anything he wrote.
Well, to the doubters who are listening, why don't you read a passage from the book?
Okay, this is probably about midway through, and I think it'll probably explain itself, especially given the book's title, which deals with all of the great verbs of life. And I think there are many people in the book who some live long lives, some not so long. So what can we learn from their watery ends? Is there some lesson on how to be friends? I think what it means is that central to living, a life that is good is a life that's forgiving. We're creatures of contact, regardless of whether to kiss or to wound, we must still come together. Like in Annie Hall, we endure twists and torsions for food we don't like, and in such tiny portions.
That's wonderful. Thank you. The book itself actually is short, although you called it in your review a heartfelt, charmingly profound American epic. What gives it the sweep in that short length?
Well, first, it pretty much covers the entire 20th century. It starts with lives of great poverty and great need early in the century, and then travels to some lives of great comfort and great luxury, and touches on just about all of us in a way, and with such lightness and such ease that you don't feel the sort of dead weight of a lot of epic works. This is just breezy. And yet by the end of the book, you feel you've seen everything and you felt everything, and that it's like a guidebook. That's all you need to know.
And it goes through the 20th century, right? Starting
yes.
with the first character as a young woman.
Yep, she starts as a little redheaded orphan who's in grinding poverty and is forced to leave school and work in a factory. And all the men are always jeering at her. She has a horrible, abusive family, which she escapes after a lot of terrible events. And I don't want to give too much away, but what's wonderful is as the book sort of leapfrogs from one era and one character to another, you gradually understand how these seemingly very disparate figures are actually related. And by the end of the book, things are tied up in a way that's just so blissfully satisfying. You don't see it coming, but it feels absolutely right. So you have that sense of the happiest landing, which is not without tragedy, but it's what art does, is that it allows you to love life in every aspect.
And apparently Rakoff was working on this, finalizing the edits from his hospital bed.
Oh, absolutely. I know he recorded the audiobook as well, which is a wonderful record to have, too, that he was clearly aware of the how severe his illness was. And I think he was well aware that he would not live much longer, and this was very much his great work. And I think it, from what I've read, it seems to have given him great satisfaction that there was that sense of, I will live long enough to finish this. This is my testament. This is my gift. And it's worthy, you know, and that's, you think, okay, that's, it's awful to contemplate this world without any more David Rakoff books and or any more David Rakoff. But at least there's the sort of glory of going out the way you wanted to.
And Rakoff died last year at the age of 47. Thank you, Paul, so much for reviewing the book and for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is The Ocean at the End of the Lane, a novel written and read by Neil Gaiman. That's The Ocean at the End of the Lane, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field. So, Julie, it turns out that the best way to get onto the bestseller list is maybe to go on Fox News.
Apparently, to have a very hostile interview that questions your credentials to write your book. In Reza Aslan's case, this has turned out to be a quick way to get your book up to the number one spot on Amazon and increase your sales by at least 35% in 48 hours.
So now, what's the book?
So the book is called Zealot, and it's a biography of Jesus. Now, this is a book that focuses on Jesus of Nazareth. It is focuses more on his personality rather than his and what he knew rather than Jesus Christ. So this is a book,
historical Jesus.
Exactly. Historical Jesus. It suggests that Jesus was illiterate. It makes a number of suggestions about his life that some people have found offensive.
All right. Now, so for those people who have not YouTubed this or Googled this or seen it on Facebook or followed it on Twitter, tell us about what the controversy is.
So this all began over the weekend, and that was when Lauren Green, who is a host of a weekly web-only show on Fox News, interviewed Reza Aslan for her show. And in the opening of the show, her first question was, "To be clear, you're a Muslim, so why did you write a book about the founder of Christianity?" Now, he responded with some surprise and explained that he has 4 degrees, that he is a scholar of religions, he's fluent in biblical Greek, and that he's been studying the origins of Christianity for 2 decades, and he also happens to be a Muslim. Now, this clip was never on television. It only appeared online, but BuzzFeed picked it up, and when they did, they put a headline on it that just made you have to click on it, which was, "Is this the most embarrassing interview Fox News has ever done?" And within hours, the video just went crazy on the internet. It was viewed 4 million times in the first couple of days. Reza Aslan immediately had thousands more Twitter followers, and of course, sales followed.
And now what was interesting about the interview is that it wasn't just, you know, that she sort of asked the question and he kind of huffily answered, but that it went on for about 12 minutes, right, with the same general line of questioning continuing throughout.
Yes, there wasn't much discussion of the actual book. The Fox News host kept asking him over and over again why, as a Muslim, he would write about Christianity. And he answered in the same way over and over again. And this was a pretty excruciating thing to watch as a journalist and as a viewer. And obviously a lot of people agreed because it just whipped around the internet immediately.
Now, to put it into perspective, the book was already a bestseller before the Fox News interview.
That's right. It was already on the New York Times bestseller list.
It was number two.
It was number two in the most recent list. It will go up to number one on the hardcover nonfiction list. And it had gotten a good amount of press. He did The Daily Show. He did Weekend Edition, which sells a lot of books. He went on Morning Joe. So there was really a lot of attention for this book already. But it seemed like what this Fox News interview did was take it outside the realm of people who buy books, people who listen to Weekend Edition and, you know, kind of keep in touch with like what's on the New York Times bestseller list, and took it outside that to a lot of people who don't really buy a lot of books, especially hardcovers.
And how do we know that it took those people to create awareness among those, a different group of people?
Well, partly because of the mediums that it was touching. I mean, a lot of, you know, BuzzFeed is not exactly known as a big promoter of books. So this was just one of those unintended consequences and something that the publisher obviously did not predict, but was completely delighted by.
But it's not entirely clear that Reza Aslan didn't know what he was getting into, because before he went on Green's show, there had been an online commentary on Fox News's website by a Fox News contributor that attacked the book in a similar way.
That's right. John S. Dickerson, who's an opinion columnist, wrote a column on FoxNews.com early last week that made similar points. He also said that Reza Aslan was concealing his identity as a Muslim, which is not true. He says that he's a Muslim on the second page of his book. And he also explains in the book his kind of unusual religious path. He was born in Iran, came to the United States after the revolution. His father, who was an MBA in Iran, had to get a new MBA in the United States. They lived for some time in Oklahoma and then moved to California, where, as he told me in an interview, he used to pretend to be Mexican because it was easier to be Mexican than Iranian in California in the 1980s. So for a while, even though he was born a Muslim and raised a Muslim, when he was 15, 16, 17 years old, he was briefly an evangelical Christian. And then when he was about 20 or 21 years old, he decided that he wanted to return to his Muslim roots. So, which also made him very interested in studying religion. And I think that that probably informed his thinking as he, you know, went through his academic career, his own unusual personal experience.
He's an academic at the University of California.
He is. So with all of that in mind, he had read John Dickerson's opinion column on FoxNews.com last week. And in fact, he and his publisher pitched Fox News very hard to get him on the network, and they rejected their suggestions that he appear on Fox and Friends, of course, their morning show.
And Lauren Green used to be on Fox and Friends before.
Yes, and she actually is, I believe, one of Roger Ailes' first hires. She's been at the network since 1996, so she is a veteran of Fox News. She's been there longer than anyone. And this show, which of course, they booked him on the show, and he did know that this was probably going to be their line of questioning. And
the show is called Spirited Debate.
It is. It's a show that focuses on religion. And when I talked to him, he said that he did expect that they would ask him something like this. He didn't expect it to dominate the entire interview and be the first question that she asked. So that may have been a bit of a surprise.
So it started off where there was all this outrage against Fox News for conducting this kind of interview against this religious scholar, Reza Aslan. And then what followed was kind of the backlash against Reza Aslan a little bit, in which people started to say, wait a minute, how much did he know about what he was getting into? And he sort of been the beneficiary of this.
Yes, and he said as much. Look, I had a feeling that this was coming. I was prepared for it. It was a pretty easy thing to defend yourself from. And he also has sold a ton of books as a result. He's gotten a lot of attention. A lot of people have wanted to interview him in the aftermath, including the New York Times. So as he told me, he was thrilled by the response to the interview or the backlash to the backlash.
Well, for all those theological scholars who thought their books would never sell in great numbers, this is very good news. Thank you, Julie.
Thanks.
Juan Gabriel Vasquez's new book, The Sound of Things Falling, is our cover review in this week's issue. And Juan joins us calling in from a couple of hours outside of Barcelona, Spain. Hi, Juan.
Hi, it's very good to hear you.
Thanks for joining us. So this is your fourth novel, but sort of your second novel. Am I correct?
It's my fifth novel and sort of my third novel.
I almost got that right. Now, why are there the two counts?
Well, I published two novels when I was 23 and 25, and there are two books I feel good about. I still feel that they were works in progress. They were places where I could learn the trade, but they shouldn't have been published. I think a writer shouldn't publish his learning process. And so I've decided to let them go, to treat them as dissolute children, and start counting from The Informers. So my novels are officially three.
Well, and you're calling us from Spain, where you lived for 13 years, but you now live in Bogota, which is also where you grew up, in Colombia?
Yes, I grew up in Colombia. As I finished my law studies, I went to law school. I had already decided that I wanted to become a writer, that the law thing didn't interest me. So I left Colombia. I got my degree, and I left Colombia when I was 23 to go to study literature in Paris, which was something of a Latin American cliche, to go to Paris to become a writer.
It's an American cliche, too.
Yes, I know, and I'm proud of that. To be following the footsteps of Hemingway and Fitzgerald, etc.
You didn't become a young lawyer, but you write about a young lawyer that the protagonist in your new novel, The Sound of Things Falling. Who is Antonia Yamara, and what happens to him?
Yes, the time I spent at law school was not lost. In that sense, it was, I have been taking advantage of it in my fiction. My novels are set in Bogota around my university, and there are lawyers in them, and students, and all the history, the Colombian history that around that place in a very particular Bogota neighborhood called La Candelaria.
And let's talk about Antonia Yamara. So he is a young lawyer in Bogota.
He's a young lawyer, rather a law professor. He spends most of his time, as I did when I was studying law, in the cafes surrounding the university, in the billiard rooms. And in one of those billiard rooms, he meets this character, Ricardo Laverde, who seems mysterious at first. It's evident that he has a secret. And Antonio becomes interested in him. And this interest afterwards turns into a sort of obsession when the character Laverde is shot and one of the stray bullets hits Antonio and, obviously changes his life. He spends the rest of them to find out why the other guy was killed, who was this guy, a way to understand what has happened to him.
And the novel takes place in the period of the drug wars and the drug kingpin Pablo Escobar in Colombia. Why did you choose to set it during that time?
I wasn't aware that I was writing about that moment, the years of terrorism and the assassinations and the almost personal war that Pablo Escobar carried out against the city, against Bogotá and its citizens. I began writing about Ricardo Laverde, and I discovered after a certain time that he was a pilot and that he had been that he had smuggled drugs into the U.S. at the beginning of the drug trade in the early 70s. And then one day I opened this magazine and I saw the photograph of a dead hippo, a hippo that had escaped from the old zoo Pablo Escobar had built in the Magdalena Valley in Colombia that had been closed when Pablo Escobar was killed. And after many years, the animals began to escape to look for food, became savage, and one of these hippos was killed. And the image of that animal just brought all these memories back to me, my own visit to Pablo Escobar's zoo, the years of living among the killings and the bombs and the shootings in the streets. Those years we lived with this feeling that, that we had grown accustomed to terrorism and to violence. And I realized this was a novel that had not been written in Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
I realized the public side of that war was readily available in the internet, and you could go and even look at a politician being shot on YouTube. There's that video. And you can look at the statistics and of the bombings and the destroyed buildings, etc. But there wasn't a place where you could go to try to understand what happened emotionally and morally to the people that were not involved in that war. So I thought my novels should try to shed a little light on that area.
Do you think of it as a political novel?
No, I think of it as a... as a novel that tries to explore that crossroads between the public world and what we call history, even if it's very recent, and the individual and the private lives of private people. I'm very interested in that place. And I think the writers that I love, the writers that have been important for me, are people who have been very good at exploring that place. Philip Roth, Joseph Conrad many years before, Don DeLillo. These are the writers. Mario Vargas Llosa. These are the people that are important for me.
Are there other writers in South America, in Latin America in general, who are exploring this period and writing in this way now? Of course, we in North America often associate Latin America with magical realism, but this is a very, very different kind of work.
Yes, I've often said that the idea that literary influence is territorial is a big misunderstanding. That is, the idea that because I am Colombian and a novelist, there's something of García Márquez that should stick to me, or I should feel forced to write in the vein of magical realism. That is not true. What writers do, I think, is try to follow a personal vision and find the method best suited to render that personal vision in literature. And more often than not, the big masters, the big lessons we learn come from other traditions. When García Márquez was starting to write, his big influences were not in the Colombian tradition. They were Faulkner and Hemingway and Kafka. And the same thing has happened to me. I look for the necessary lessons to write my books outside of the Colombian tradition, in the English language tradition, or in the old 19th century Russian novels, which were very political in their own way. So no, I magical realism is a sort of great new way to look at the world that García Márquez practically invented in the 60s, but it has nothing to do with my world.
And now you are, of course, you're 40.
Yes.
And so really part of a new generation of Latin American writers. Is there anything that you think that marks or distinguishes your generation of South American writers?
No, I can't find something that unifies the generation in the same way that, for instance, their relationship with the Cuban Revolution unified what we call the Latin American boom, Gabriel García Márquez generation. They lived through a very special political moment, even if their books are completely different. They all have this same idea, the books, that they had to reinvent Latin America in literature because there was no such thing as a Latin American novelistic tradition up to that point. They were isolated novels, but there was no tradition to speak of. So they had to build that. They had to invent that. We don't have the same obligation. We don't have a single political objective that, in a way, we gather around, such as the Cuban Revolution was then. So it's a very different moment and a very dispersed moment. And I think that's good. I think that's interesting. The lack of something to gather around makes our literature very varied and diverse.
Okay. Well, the book that we're talking about now is The Sound of Things Falling. On our cover, Edmund White called it a gripping novel, absorbing right to the end. And the author is Juan Gabriel Vasquez. Juan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Greg Coles joins us with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
So what is new on the bestseller list this week?
Well, last week I talked about the combo lists, so I thought this week I'd talk about the hardcover list, where really there's not a lot new, actually. On the fiction side of things, Robert Galbraith, who's really, of course, J.K. Rowling, makes her way to number one this week with The Cuckoo's Calling. That book is not new on the list. It's in its second week, but it climbs up from number three last week. The two books that are new on the fiction list this week are Light of the World by James Lee Burke. That's new at number five. Burke has had a long-running series of books about a Louisiana detective, Dave Robichaux, who splits his time, as Burke himself does, between Louisiana and Montana.
That sounds rough.
Yeah. This book is set in Montana and shows Burke dealing with a psychopathic serial killer. In the book review, Marilyn Stasio noted that Burke has become increasingly biblical in his references and that this book is especially full of fire and brimstone.
All righty.
Another interesting thing about Burke is that he comes from a real writing family. He's descended from the Scottish philosopher Edmund Burke. His first cousin was André Debussy. His daughter, Allifair Burke, is also a crime writer. And in fact, Dave Robichaux's daughter is named Allifair in these series. And of course, André Debussy's son, André Debussy III, is also a writer. So a lot of talent in that family.
Wait, we must correct. He was not Scottish, Edmund Burke. He was Irish.
It's all the same.
We would get a lot of people very angry.
The British philosopher, Edmund Burke. Then at number 10, Philippa Gregory, who wrote The Other Bolin Girl and The White Queen, has a new book called The White Princess concerning Elizabeth of York's marriage to Henry Tudor and the emotional repercussions among the princesses. That book is new at number 10.
Oh, very timely.
On the nonfiction side of things, there are also just two new books this week. At number 5, there's a book called Breakpoint by a guy named Jeff Stibel. He is a brain scientist and an entrepreneur. And this book is his thoughts about the internet as a network. And he kind of draws the analogy between the human brain as a neural network and the internet as a computer network. And he looks at how complicated networks evolve to make the argument that once they reach kind of a critical mass in terms of size, they start to shrink and focus more on quality than on quantity. And he turns around and because he's an entrepreneur, he applies some of that to this book to turn it into like a business advice how-to book as well. It's kind of looking at ways that businesses can capitalize on the direction that the internet will be heading in.
I think I already don't understand that book. But
Well, here's one that you might understand better. At number 9, new on the list this week, Shirley Jones has written a memoir called Shirley Jones with a co-writer, Wendy Lee. Shirley Jones, of course, played Shirley Partridge in The Partridge Family. She really got her start in some Rodgers and Hammerstein's musicals.
Carousel, and
Oklahoma. She played the farm girl Lori in Oklahoma. A lot of very innocent, wholesome roles. She was also the prim librarian, Marion the librarian, in The Music Man, the Meredith Wilson
But it
musical.
Turns out...
Well, this book is pretty open about her sex life. It's a very earthy book. It's not an especially scandalous sex life. She was married for a long time to Jack Cassidy. Her son is Sean Cassidy. Her stepson is David Cassidy, who was on the Partridge Family with her. Jack Cassidy apparently was very avid in his sexuality. Before he married her, he apparently had an affair with Cole Porter, which she knew about and was okay with. And he was quite the swinger. He encouraged her into a threesome with a chorus girl from a Las Vegas show that they were playing. And she willingly went along with that, although she says she didn't enjoy it that much and begged off when he asked for a repeat, a three-peat maybe. And... just talks about how she was very much a product of her times, the 60s, the kind of the free swinging 60s. She went over to Joan Collins's house once and Joan Collins's husband, the singer Tony Newley, stood up at one point and said, "Right, we've got pornos. Let's all get naked and watch." Again, she declined. A lot of this book is about married sex, but she writes quite a lot about sex and is very open about how much she enjoys it and how Jack Cassidy really kind of introduced her to the wide world of sexuality and how happy she was that he did.
And still frisky at 79.
Still frisky at 79. She's got a second marriage to the comedian Marty Ingalls, and she talks in the book about how much he still loves her body and how she likes to strip down and shake it for him and how happy that makes him.
Okay, on that upbeat note, thank you so much, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.